We're talking about trauma-informed immigration policies on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Associated Press and other news sources reported this week that the federal government is holding dozens of separated migrant children at hotels instead of detention centers as they await deportation. According to CBS, from March through June, the Border Patrol says it apprehended more than 6,000 unaccompanied children. Carla Marisol Vargas is an attorney with the Texas Civil Rights Project.
They have suffered trauma, getting to the United States, and now they are suffering trauma at the hands of our government.
What do you want to know about federal immigration policies and procedures pertaining to detained children? We're at 800-642-1234. Jacqueline Nguyen is an associate professor in the Cognitive and Developmental Sciences program in the Department of Educational Psychology at UW-Milwaukee. Jacqueline, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Me.
Before we get started here, I want to get your reaction to the news this week that the Border Patrol is holding detained children in hotels. What type of risk of trauma is that?
Well, I think the risks have been laid out in the science and developmental psychology for decades, right? Every time that children are separated from their primary caregivers, from the social support networks that they have and the people that they trust and rely on for care, it has long-term adverse effects on their development. It impacts their sense of security, their attachment relationships, leads to cognitive declines, social and emotional declines. I mean, in all the domains of development, this can impair growth.
You spent last fall on sabbatical focusing on the impact of immigration policies, visiting places like Tijuana, Mexico. What did you learn from that experience?
Yeah, that was a really fantastic opportunity that I was able to take advantage of. What I've been doing work on immigrant families, immigrant children and families for quite a long time, but I wanted to know what was happening on the ground, especially at the borders. Certainly immigration policies impact people all over, not just at border towns, but because of the rapid changes in our nation's policies, I kind of wanted to know exactly what was happening on the ground. And so I learned a number of things. I learned how quickly the policies can change from day to day and how chaotic the impact is on families. And that has incredible bearing on children's sense of stability and optimism and hope for the future if the target for them keeps changing as they attempt to seek asylum. It's incredibly difficult. So I was working largely in Tijuana, but had a chance to visit a number of shelters and visit with some binational agencies. And it was really interesting to see that individuals were still really optimistic. I worked largely with asylum seekers and folks who were presenting themselves at the border with claims of persecution or the need to flee from their homes, of course. And individuals were patient. They were willing to go through the system. But again, the targets kept changing. And I think what really resonated with me was that parents and children just wanted a sense of normalcy. They wanted to play. They missed having fields to play soccer in. They missed going to school. They wanted to engage in any kind of, you know, even minor educational activities or, you know, arts and crafts that seemed to give them a sense of normalcy.
You were kicking a soccer ball around with a child. They went and grabbed the cell phone of their parent. What did they show you?
So this was a girl about 10, 11 years old, and we were just playing. She had been really withdrawn for much of the day and then started warming up. The family was working with some lawyers to understand their claims to asylum and to file the paperwork. So it is a really long process. She had probably been there for 7 hours that day. And as you can imagine, keeping a 10, 11-year-old still inpatient for 7 hours is an arduous undertaking under normal circumstances. And so we were just playing inside this office space. And she showed me on this, she went and grabbed the cell phone and she started just pulling up pictures of of her father and family members in the hospital after they had been attacked by some government forces, and her father had passed away. She was there with extended family, and then she just went back, and the family had taken those pictures and brought them as documentation of their need to flee persecution, and she just went back and gave the phone back and started playing again.
Are these families that you visited with mostly coming from Central America?
They are coming from all over, primarily Central America. I think that comprises the majority of the individuals who are presenting themselves for asylum at the southern border, at the U.S.-Mexico border. But individuals were coming from a large number of countries. I think on every given day, we were seeing individuals from 8 countries with the need for multiple language interpreters. Folks were coming from Russia or had Russian backgrounds, from the Dominican, from Haiti, from France, even. There were a number of French nationals, Caribbean nationals, Africans, Pakistanis. I mean, individuals were coming from all over the place.
I can imagine when it was shifting laws, regulations, and policies prior to COVID, prior to the pandemic, I can not imagine what it must be like right now for the asylum program as the pandemic is forcing so many people back to their home countries.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really acute problem right now. I spoke yesterday to a friend who I met in my first visit to Tijuana, and he had just been down there recently again, came back a week ago, and I was asking, you know, what the situation looked like, and it is dire. So whereas when we were down there, I had crossed at the San Isidro port, and there were a number of tents set up for individuals to live there daily, just as they were, again, awaiting their right to be heard. And I think there were maybe, you know, 5 to 10 individuals encamped permanently there. At this point, there are something like 40 to 50 encampments set up with people permanently staying there in really unsafe conditions, you know, lacking food, lacking access to running water, electricity, all of our basic needs. The shelters are overcrowded. Many of the shelters could house, you know, anywhere between 10 individuals or 10 families, up to 30 or 40 at the most. I'm sure they're still trying to maintain those numbers for safety reasons. There simply aren't enough beds or resources, but the shelters are absolutely overcrowded and people are really trapped. They have to stay in Mexico. There was a policy called the Migrant Protections Protocol that required that individuals stay in Mexico until they were they had their asylum hearings or had to be returned to Mexico if their asylum was denied. And now the numbers have grown exponentially.
We're talking with UW-Milwaukee Associate Professor of Educational Psychology, Jackie Nguyen, studies the developmental experiences of immigrants, refugees, and people with ethnic minority backgrounds, looking at the immigration policies and trauma-informed care of detained children. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Jackie, as these families await hearings, await what comes next, is there any structure for the children? Are there any educational offerings or distractions of any sort?
Yeah, minimal. I think, you know, there are groups and social service agencies, nonprofit agencies and organizations that have been doing this work for decades. I mean, immigration and the deportation of individuals and families and family separation is not a very new issue. It certainly has grown and taken the spotlight front and center as policies have exacerbated the challenges and the numbers. But some of these groups have been engaging in different services. I know that there is some organizing to bring mobile schooling to the various shelters. But the shelters are spread really far apart on difficult terrain. It's tough to get to. Certainly, schooling isn't happening on a daily basis. There are groups that are bringing supplies to the different shelters and folks in different encampments. And certainly some of those supplies are crayons and paper and arts and crafts materials. That's great, especially for the younger set of kids. And honestly, the kids will take anything. You know, one of the shelters that I visited, you know, the kids were all waiting for our group to arrive and they just wanted toys. They're like, okay, what toys did you give me? You know, forget educational activities, like give me a truck, give me a doll, give me something I can have fun with and cherish and something that might be my own or that I can share with others. I know the kids were, you know, for centuries, people have made play and engaged in whatever materials they have around them to have fun. So kids would play with chickens running around and so on. But there is nothing structured. Children cannot apply to go to schools in Mexico. You have to be a Mexican national in order to go to formal schooling. So really, we're talking about a patchwork of attempts to provide some stimulation. You can imagine the long-term cognitive effects of that, the physical effects. I mean, children aren't getting fruits and vegetables on a daily basis.
Literally little lives in limbo.
Exactly.
Yeah. Looking at efforts to move toward trauma-informed immigration policies involving migrant children, Jacqueline Nguyen is an associate professor of cognitive and developmental sciences at UW-Milwaukee. Are you an immigrant? What was your experience moving to a new country, a new place? How did you adjust to your environment? Were you a child when you came to this country? What do you remember about that journey? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Jacqueline Nguyen right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're learning about how to help migrant children recover from trauma as they are placed in U.S. detention centers and shelters. And as we're learning this week, hotels. The Trump administration is detaining immigrant children as young as one in hotels, sometimes for weeks before sending them back to their home countries amid the pandemic. That's according to documents obtained by the Associated Press. What questions do you have about the shared experiences of young immigrants and refugees? Have you worked with children who have recently come to this country? What is that like? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Jacqueline Nguyen is an associate professor of cognitive and developmental sciences at UW-Milwaukee, and she stays with us. Jacqueline, you've been collaborating with researchers around the country and participated in the Research Policy Collaborative. What is the effort there?
Yeah, it's a really fantastic effort run primarily by scholars out of Penn State University to translate or to connect scientists, so researchers, specifically in family sciences or developmental sciences with policymakers and allow us to have a conversation so that the science can inform potentially policies that individuals are thinking about proposing.
What type of policies have come together around this?
I specifically have worked on with a few legislators who are interested, of course, on immigration and deportation policies. Most recently, Representative Lowenthal introduced an act. It was the Honor Our Commitment Act in response to the Trump administration's reinterpretation of the Memorandum of Agreement to exclude refugees or to begin to deport refugees who had arrived in the United States prior to 1995. And this legislation, we worked with his office for a number of months, and they really were open to hearing about the science, hearing about the economic impact of deportation on communities, hearing about the impact on families, and understanding and using that science in the act. And in fact, they included a citation, I believe, in the legislation, in the bill that was introduced.
So he is a representative in California. What was the reaction by the congressman in terms of what you're trying to accomplish?
Well, I think one thing that the Research to Policy Collaborative does really well is they approach all individuals, all members of Congress to say, you know what, we're here. We're a group of scientists. What questions do you have? What are you interested in learning about? What legislation are you working on? And how can we help? And so the relationships that have developed have been primarily driven by legislators who are really interested in learning more about the science. I think they have to be experts on such a broad range of issues, whereas as scientists, we spend our lives committed to exploring a narrow set of issues. And so we get to interpret and translate in the broad range of research to individuals so that they can make decisions kind of on singular issues and bills. And so that office in particular, Representative Lowenthal's office, was very open to research. I think he was actually has a background in psychology himself. I think he was a professor before he came to Congress. And so so his office was very open, but other offices have been too. We've been engaged in a number of conversations with, again, a number of policymakers.
The situations at the border are dire. The trauma for these children, as you have seen, runs so deep. And immigration itself is such a heavily politicized issue. How do you navigate that and get policy to action? You know, connect all those dots in between.
That's such a great question. I think that has been the area of my greatest growth and learning as I've begun to engage in more of this policy work or engaged in translating science to policy. I think that it's certainly difficult in many ways. What we do as scientists is, you know, we offer a set of suggestions and potentially implications and interventions that can be taken up. And it is up to policymakers to adopt some of those changes in many ways and to fund them. And I think individuals are really interested at the federal level in understanding, you know, what sources of funding they can use to target toward different initiatives that certainly align with their personal and political beliefs. But to the extent that we can offer really sound scientific evidence to say, you know what, this is real, right? So separating families unequivocally has traumatic impacts on children and families, and those impacts are long lasting. So what can we do at the policy level to curb family separation to begin with? Let's try and limit the trauma and prevent the trauma first. And then where trauma has occurred, as it has for over 6,000 family units, as reported by Amnesty International, what can we do once those families and children are reunited and in the United States, if they become integrated in our communities, what can we do to support them to facilitate, a developmental pathway where they can begin to flourish and thrive and have their personal traumatic histories met and understood and responded to with sensitivity and care.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with UW-Milwaukee's Jackie Nguyen, looking at trauma-informed care of migrant children and immigration policies. So when you look at some of those interventions and, that would be vital, that would be top-line priorities for you from a psychological standpoint, can you explain what those are?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, I should say with a caveat that I am not a trauma specialist. I'm coming into this work and learning from incredible colleagues who do work on trauma. I typically study kind of normative developmental pathways, but the context has made things not so normal, I think, for individuals. So I just caution that I'm not the leading trauma expert by any stretch of the imagination. But I think some of the interventions have to, again, address preventing the trauma. Families should be detained together if detention has to occur at all. The immigration and asylum seeking process is already traumatic in and of itself. Individuals are often seeking asylum because of traumatic events, either acute incidents, single incidents, or chronic trauma. And so just understanding that the immigration and asylum seeking process is a second layer of trauma is important. And I think there a lot of education needs to occur. I think we can also activate some existing resources and work with community agencies and groups that have been doing this work for a long time in order to provide support to them to continue to serve families impacted by some of these policies. To begin to support individuals multinationally who have been deported and are kind of in limbo, right? So individuals aren't necessarily deported to their country of origin. And so they're trying to find a new space for themselves and their families as mm-hmm. they kind of live perpetually, again, in limbo. So how can we support individuals to, again, flourish and thrive? How can we advocate for children, for example, to have access to schooling, even if they're not nationals? And then in the United States, I think we can provide a lot of support and services to families and children who still have long-term effects, even post-reunification.
Jackie, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, it was a pleasure. Thank you for discussing this important issue.
Jacqueline Nguyen is an associate professor in the Cognitive and Developmental Sciences program in the Department of Educational Psychology at UW-Milwaukee. Just ahead, we talk with the host and writer of the PBS show Prehistoric Road Trip. What dinosaur questions do you have? Bring them on, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.